everyone. Welcome to the podcast. I'm Savina. I'm excited to be hosting alongside Maya today. And today we have a very exciting guest, Andrew. And Andrew O'Neill is a head teacher at All Saints Catholic College. And earlier this year, Andrew made waves with a bold decision to lengthen school days and ban smartphones at his school for a two-month pilot for kids in year 7 and year 8. It sparked a debate around social media's impact on teenage mental health, social skills, and academic focus.
Increasingly, kids' relationships with their phone are coming under the microscope. Countries like Australia, for instance, are currently seeking a social media ban for children under 16 on account of research findings that adolescents' social media usage doubles the risk of experiencing poor mental health outcomes and also is correlated with negative academic outcomes. Even Eton College has taken a leaf out of All Saints' book. At the beginning of this year, the school banned new pupils from bringing smartphones to school, and instead pupils were given a school-issued basic headset. But that is enough about Eton College. Welcome to the pod, Andrew.
Hi, yeah, thanks for having me on.
Well, yeah, we'd love to just kick us off with, I guess, you know, the question you've probably been asked the most about in the last year. But what if you could walk us through this decision to trial a smartphone ban?
Yeah, so I think, well, mobile phones have always been a distraction. And I've worked in, you know, I've been a teacher for over 20 years. And, you know, I exist in that phase of being a teacher in the pre-smartphone era and the post. And in both of those eras, that they have always been a distraction. Now, I became the head teacher at All Saints. It was actually previously called Sign Manning, and I think we're going to get into some of the stuff around the journey of the school in a bit. But when I started in 2016, we banned smartphones straight away. Children weren't allowed to bring them to school, and that's always been the case for us, and it's always worked really well. When I first arrived here, the rule was the same. Children weren't allowed to have their phones, but actually what was happening in practice was that children were using them on the school site, and they were, you know, calling each other, getting in contact with one another, and it just caused a whole load of problems. So before starting, I'd made this rule. But really where this all came from was post-COVID, actually. And maybe we'll get into this later, but we live taught all children from day one of the pandemic. And we did that by, you know, really planning from January 2020, when we started to see the pandemic take hold and we saw places like France and Spain go into lockdown. We thought, look, we want to be really innovative here because, you know, our country might go into lockdown. And so how could we push education into children's homes? We actually did that by harnessing the power of smartphones and devices. And we worked out a way of doing it. And it was really cutting edge. But actually, by the time we got to the end of lockdown, we actually, as a school, but also as a society, we were guilty of making children addicted to their devices. And a few months after the end of lockdown, we began to notice, and I noticed, and speaking to colleagues actually around the country, that there was a general malaise and apathy amongst young people in school. And children who'd we'd been teaching before lockdown, who were bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and happy-go-lucky, and all of a sudden they were sort of like quiet, lethargic, disconnected, apathetic. And we just thought this whole connection to a community had broken off and they'd been connected completely to something else. And, you know, I think to a degree that was their phones and their devices. And, you know, you'd find children that wouldn't do their homework, and you'd talk to their parents and they were saying, well, they're not out on the street, they're up in their bedroom. And they would just be endlessly scrolling on their phones. And we felt, look, we need to do something here to reconnect these children and also the children coming through back into their school community and give them that greater sense of belonging to actually what goes on around them, which is building human relationships and making friends and playing. Because we often assume that secondary school children don't want to play, but it's so not true. They love playing. So we took a plan to 10 Downing Street and we had this concept of piloting it around different regions of the country. They thought it was a great idea and they really loved it. And they were like, look, post-pandemic, this is the kind of thing we need to be doing. But unfortunately, the Partygate erupted a week later, and then there was just this like catalogue of political events that make this lovely little pilot just like fall behind the sofa. And so it basically got confined to the dustbin of nice ideas by those in the political classes. So sometime later, we went away and we just thought, look, let's just do it anywhere. Let's run a pilot ourselves and see if we can do something. Focus on, you know, scaling it back a little bit, focusing on the younger years, and then going with our own version of it. And that's what we did. We did a effectively an 11-hour day. It was often touted as a 12-hour day. I think there was some miscounting of hours, which was an early breakfast and quite an expansive breakfast that also then included activities and some sporting activities. The school day, then getting homework completed. And that was a really interesting part of it and a pivotal part of it. But not only getting homework completed, there was one-to-one tuition, small group maths and English sessions going on. So real catch-up work. And then the fun activities where we brought external services in, because the last 14, 15 years, we've seen those decimated for our young people, and also in a cost of living crisis. For our families, where we're situated, that's a bit of a luxury. And then we ended it with a dinner where the children sat together and we cooked for them. And often members of staff who are around, certainly my senior leadership team, we'd have dinner with them too. So it was all about building connections.
Yeah, it sounds like, I guess, a real holistic view of it. And so I guess the headline news is like smartphone ban. But in the reality of it, you're creating a really, like a holistic community-based kind of centered new program for these children to become, you know, re-enter into what school life can and should be and what their community can look like as well.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that I've always been at pains to say. I mean, you know, the Sunday Times broke the story and I worked with them on that. And, you know, I was like, look, we're creating this provision because we want to create a community and reconnect children back into it, give them that sense of belonging to their school environment. And this is something that can be replicated. And obviously they needed the headline, and the great headline was mobile phones. But the wonderful thing about that was that it really captured the zeitgeist of the time, which was that mobile phones are a problem. And I should actually qualify that. Mobile phones aren't the problem. It's the use of mobile phones. And there's a nuance there. And realistically, it's the use of social media. Because actually, there are some great uses of the tech around mobile phones for learning. And lots of schools, mine included, we set homework that can be accessed on a mobile phone so they can see their homework planner. There's some great languages apps. They're reading, like Bedrock app is device based. So there's phenomenal uses of them, but there's misuse and abuse of mobile phones that's the real problem. So it also coincided with Jonathan Haidt releasing his book The Anxious Generation almost at the same time. And you know, I'd like to admit that I knew that he was releasing that at that exact point, but I didn't. It was just pure luck.
Yeah, and I love that what you're doing is such a sort of it's a response to the sort of dereliction of community organizations that young people should have access to. Yeah. And I think particularly with the smartphone ban, it's increasingly limiting kids' usage on smartphones is falling on the shoulders of parents who are already overworked, already overstretched. And I just think the initiative that All Saints took under your leadership is just such a brilliant one to try and harness the community institutions that we still have in order to promote connection and, yeah, foster in real life connections for kids.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with the social media and devices, it's like giving a teenager a dummy. It's like their version of like a dummy that you give a baby. And I think, you know, if you think about schools and the way that schools function, maybe your schooling, I certainly think of my schooling growing up in the Northeast, how rich it was. You know, I went to school in Darlington, I went to a comprehensive school, and you know, when I first started the school, it was a really quite a rough school. But we had some great teachers, and we there was lots of opportunity there, and there was lots of sport, and there was, you know, some great friends. And you know, if we think about the school sector at the minute and what's happening with our teenagers, we've really got a question. Are we setting an environment in which children are thriving and enjoying their upbringing? Because I think back to school and I remember, you know, playing for the football team. I remember being into some musicals, singing pretty badly, and going on school trips. I remember going to France, doing a whole host of activities that weren't lessons. Now, obviously, I've got my grades to show for what happened, but those are the memories that have remained important to me, and which is how I want to run my school, in creating the same memories, same types of memories for the children that come here. And my fear is that the way we've been going with this is that when children will look back, what were your teenage years like, that we'll ask in, say, 20 years, and it'll be like, well, I went to school and then I sat in my bedroom and looked up, scrolled through my phone. And it's not an upbringing that you're going to look back on and think, I really thrived as a teenager. So we've got to address that.
Absolutely. And to sort of create a school environment where students are able to thrive, you've also got to have other members of the school community thriving as well. And so that brings us on quite nicely to you offering recently semi-flexible schedules for your staff. So could you outline why you made this change and why All Saints is a better learning environment because of them?
Yeah, I suppose I've got to go back a little bit here because that kind of speaks to the journey that the school has been on in the last sort of 9 years. So in 2016, we were either the least popular or one of the least popular schools in England. We had 8 applications for children to come in 2017, to the end of my first year. And, you know, that's really difficult. And when you exist in a school and take over a school that was basically, they were talking about closing it, the local authority and the diocese who would have had to have made that decision. You know, you have to value your staff because it's quite difficult to recruit anyone from the outside in. And so, you know, I think one thing that we've had to do is we've been on this journey of school improvement. But in order to transform a school, you have to be hugely innovative and you have to invest massively in the teachers that you've got and the members of staff that you've got. And I think that's what we did. And that's how we continued that level of innovation. There's a whole host of things that we've done that are quite different to lots of other schools. But the flexible working thing, I talk about it being the holy grail of the education sector, because, you know, certainly post-COVID, most people work from home to some degree, except teachers and nurses and people whose profession is place-based. And that's really challenging because, you know, schools have got more challenging in terms of the environment and what we're dealing with. And so, you know, I approach this with, well, how do I recruit the best, keep the best? And the answer to that was providing even better conditions for people. So we actually reduced class sizes, because that reduces marking load for the teachers. We reduce the amount of contact teaching time. So in most schools in the country, teachers have 10% non-contact. At All Saints, we made that 30% non-contact. And then once we got to that point of reducing class sizes, reducing contact time, we were able to say, okay, we can now re-timetable this to the point where we can give every teacher one morning a week where they can come in at 10:45. And in that period before they come in, it's up to them what they do. And, you know, there was some real reaction to that that was quite astonishing. So like certain factions of that, I would say that what would be traditionally called the right-wing press say, you know, shouting that teachers are lazy, they get all of this time. And it's like, well, teachers in my school, that we don't mandate this, but they're often getting in at 7:15 or 7:30, still here at 6:00 because they have that sense of service and duty and vocation. Now, what's a morning off going to do?
I was just really curious, obviously, because you've invested so much time and effort into teachers, and it sounds incredible what you've been able to do with that. What was their reaction when you introduced the smartphone ban and the other kind of community changes as well? How did they react to that? Because they are the ones in the classroom implementing it and working with the pupils to make sure that this change does happen as well.
I mean, they were delighted. I mean, I think one of the things that's really interesting is lots of our staff have only ever worked here. And so that what they get here is what they think is the norm. But what's really interesting is in the last couple of years, we've had teachers who've left and then come back because they realised, wow, you do things phenomenally different. And in the last 2 years, we've actually invested in more experienced teachers to come in to try and take the school to the next level. And they've come in and they are like genuinely shocked. Like, they're like, wow, have you created these conditions in which we can, you know, your children behave so unbelievably well, we're able to teach them without distraction, but actually there's a lovely atmosphere and the conditions that we've got are better than any school we've ever worked in. So we're incredibly proud of that. But I think it speaks to the kind of concept of innovation that we've always had. And it goes back to that point of school improvement. To transform a school, you have to be innovative and you have to be prepared to take risks and try new things. And that's, you know, that's why we've that sort of the live teaching, some of our approach to special educational needs and in recruiting academic support assistant, the extended school day, building Lighthouse, flexible working, and our network of maintained schools that we've developed. These are all innovative, different things that that's just become part and parcel of how we lead in this school.
Yeah, so to just sort of like zoom in on one of those innovations that you mentioned, Lighthouse. You're the CEO of Lighthouse Data, a platform that provides insight on all state-funded schools in England. What did draw you to this project, and how has it gone so far?
So Lighthouse is something that I built during lockdown. It's an online analytics platform that effectively provides interactive analysis at the fingertips of every school in the country. So you're looking at has data on 24,000 schools. And to build it, I saw a problem. I saw a problem with how the government uses data, which is not brilliantly. It tends to silo data. And it hasn't been forward thinking. If we go back 10 years, it hasn't been forward thinking in its use of big data and how you stitch together big data and then use AI to do some of the analysis. So in effect, I've stitched together 240 million data points. These were late nights during lockdown. And what I've done is I've brought to the front the information that is essential and that you'd need to gather about, say, one school or potentially a range of schools, or if you wanted every single school in the country. And I think the issue being addressed, you know, in all of this is information and getting the right information really quickly, which is nearly always the problem. And as I said, the DfE and actually all government departments, they don't tend to connect up all of their data to provide a rounded picture of what's going on. And that's what I was attempting to do just in the education sector. But it should be something that's happening across government. And if we think about young people, we should be connecting up educational outcomes, finances of schools and SEND and health data and building a better picture of what's going on in our society. But we haven't done that yet. And it's totally bizarre that we haven't done that yet, because we could massively improve teaching practice, but also how we deal with young people and some of the most vulnerable people in our society. And, you know, as you said, it's been used by lots and lots of different people. And we continue to just make it completely free, because we are effectively taking government data that's just made available in just enormous spreadsheets, stitching it together and making it easier for people to use. And I always felt that if we want to make things better, we should just make this a free service. And lots of people have used it. But the thing I'm most proud about is that it's the fact that officials in the Department for Education use it. And I've been contacted by officials over the years to say, could you analyse this for me and tell me what this is saying? So, you know, that's almost like a bit of a side project, but it does have a real sort of utility to it as well.
I mean, there's a whole side conversation about public digital infrastructure here, and I feel like we could have you on just to talk about what governance looks like for data storytelling. It's fascinating, and definitely stuff me and Maya are definitely interested in. But I would love to touch upon, so the fact that, you know, you've got government officials contacting you, you've got podcasters who also come and want to have a chat with you, you know, there's kind of a lot of attention, I guess, for you and the school and growing kind of interest in what you're doing. And so how have you found that balance, this kind of growing interest and media attention alongside, you know, your duties as a head teacher and the school to make sure that it's still thriving? What's that looking like?
I think it's fine, to be honest. I think that, you know, I'm a bit of a workaholic, and I love what I do. So, you know, I thrive on the sense of just constantly having new things coming at me. And the media stuff has been, it hasn't just been a new thing. It's been something that has developed over a longer period of time. And, you know, where we're situated, we're literally just a couple of hundred metres from Grenfell Tower. So, you know, that massively has impacted and affected our school community. And, you know, at the time of Grenfell, there was quite a lot of media attention, and, you know, did a lot of interviews back then about a topic that's really, really difficult to speak about and articulate, you know, when there's, you know, so much anger about what happened, and rightly so, and then trying to speak from the point of view as a head teacher. And then I had to learn very quickly how to speak, which I'm not doing now, speak fluently about something that's really quite complex.
So can I ask, so have you ever done media training, or I guess how have you then built up your public speaking skills? Because you do come across as like extremely passionate and you speak quite pointedly about what's important to you.
Well, I haven't done any media training, but I think, 20 years in a classroom with secondary school kids, teenagers who don't necessarily want to be there all the time is the best type of media training you're ever going to get.
Absolutely. Okay, to round off this discussion, I'd just like to move into a couple of quick fire questions for you. If you were not a teacher, what would you be and why?
I don't know what I'd be. That's a really difficult thing. I think as teachers, such a vocation. I really don't know. I've got a very odd skill set. You know, you've just talked about the sort of speaking side of things and articulating. But, you know, as a head teacher, you have to be a bit of a Swiss Army knife anyway, because you have to know finances inside out. You have to be able to be good at public speaking. You have to be able to put into place complex systems and make sure that they function very well. But also, I've got quite a technical expertise, so the stuff around Lighthouse, for example, so the ability to build a database, quite a complex database, and also then make it interactive and build it into a website, is something that I just taught myself a couple of years ago. So I don't know, but it's hard to pinpoint one thing, but I suppose maybe something entrepreneurial or innovative or something completely different from teaching, maybe. But I don't know a particular job.
Yeah, I would just go completely left field and be like a cartographer or something like that. I'd love to know what tech invention makes you the most excited.
Well, it's boring and cheesy, but AI, I think, is exciting and terrifying in equal measure. And, you know, interestingly, people are really obsessed with generative AI at the moment, and it is phenomenal and brilliant, and I use it pretty much daily. But, you know, on the data front with Lighthouse, you know, I'm going back for 4 and a bit years, we were using AI to actually analyze some really, really complex data around thousands and thousands of schools and get it to provide us with insights as to what was going on. And, you know, that's phenomenal. So to be able to get it to do that is great, but you do need the human input to actually genuinely interpret what it means, and then to take it to the next step of what do we do and how do we do this in a way that will be impactful, and how will people feel about these changes? And that's I think really exciting.
And connectedly, what is a sort of tech innovation that makes you the most scared right now?
It's kind of the same thing. It's the abuse of AI, and also the how it can be used. I mean, look at social media, how AI can completely warp views and change elections, and it can be used for so many unethical things around cheating in exams, for example, or, you know, plagiarizing parts of your degree. And I think the regulation of it is going to be phenomenally difficult. So we have to get to a point of understanding the best ways to use it and the best ways to regulate it. And that's just a total minefield. And I'm glad that that's not my job.
I'm sure you would still excel in that job. I would love to wrap us up with, what is an inspirational quote that stuck with you through your career?
I think the motto for our school, we're a Catholic school, and the motto for the school is from John chapter 10. And actually, you often see people at sports games with 10-10 on placards, John 10-10, which is, I've come so that you might have life, life in all its fullness. And we talk about that all the time in school. You know, we're trying to give a fullness of life to the children that we educate. And I think that kind of sticks with me, because it's the word fullness. And, you know, so often I think schools will get one part of that right. They might get the academic side right, but the school is loveless. And then on the flip side, they get the other bit right, which is the fun bit, but it's vacuous, because it doesn't really give children the education, the keys to opportunity that they need. And I've always taken the view that fullness of life and fullness of education, which, you know, I'm committed to serving the children that I educate, is about giving them everything, you know, doing everything phenomenally well rather than just a couple of things. And if we can do that and keep the plates spinning, we can genuinely transform the lives of the most vulnerable, the most disadvantaged that come into our care and our contact.
Oh, it's rare that sort of discussions like this, just quick 30 minutes discussions, like, leave me feeling so hopeful. Yeah, this really has. So thank you for all the work that you do.
Yeah, thanks.
So please do let our listeners know where they can learn more about Lighthouse Data.
If you go to lighthousedata.org.
And yeah, please, for our listeners, leave a review if you enjoyed the episode, because it helps us get amazing guests like Andrew O'Neill who I just want to thank once again for coming on.
Thank you. Goodbye. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.